DiscerningHearts.com presents Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I'm delighted to be joined by Adam English, who's an associate professor of religion at Campbell University. He's the author of Theology Remixed, Christianity as Story, Game, Language, Culture. With Adam English, we go inside the pages of The Saint Who Would Be Santa Claus, The True Life and Trials of Nicholas of Myra, published by Baylor University Press. Thank you so much for joining me.
So good to be with you.
The Saint Who Would Be Santa Claus. It's an exceptional book. Thank you so much. He really is deserving of the telling, the full telling of his story. He's not an elf or anything like that, that we've kind of made him out to be, or his name was grabbed and attached to.
That's so true. Partly what has happened is that you had scholars in the 20th century who very much doubted that he even existed or did anything that we know of him. And then you had sort of the pop idea of Santa Claus, St. Nicholas, that was full of legends and, you know, fantastical stories. So no one has as yet really done the hard work of going back to the primary documents and really researching who he was. But as it turns out, he was a Christian pastor who lived a life of service, worked for justice, practiced generosity, and really made a huge difference in the lives of many, many people. And it's a story worth telling.
Let's talk about his era, the year he lived on the earth, and what location would we find him?
Sure. St. Nicholas was born in the late 3rd century, the late 200s. When he was born, Christianity was a persecuted minority religion. When he died, in the around maybe the year 335 or thereabouts, Christianity was not only a legalized religion, but the favored faith of the empire. And, you know, people were coming into the church by droves. And so he witnessed a huge transformation in his own life. He was born and lived out his life on what is now the southern coast of Turkey. Then they would have called it just Asia Minor, born in the city of Patara, and then ultimately became bishop of a church in Myra.
What were the times like in that particular area? Suffering persecution, yes, or was it a time of freedom?
Yes, no, he lived a moment of probably what became the most intense phase of persecution around the year 303. The last and greatest effort to stamp out Christianity was made, in which, you know, hundreds were put to death or sent to the mines or tortured. And there is some evidence that Nicholas also suffered from those tortures or was imprisoned. He did not die as a martyr, but he did suffer for the faith. And so it was a very intense time for him to live. Ultimately, Emperor Constantine came to the East and liberated the Christians there, and made Christianity a legalized faith, and went about a campaign of rebuilding churches and restoring property that was lost during the persecutions. And so Nicholas was able to see in his lifetime, again, going from this position of being afraid for your life and living in an underground sort of faith existence to being the religion that the emperor himself favored and was a part of.
You talk about the primary documents that you used to be able to go back and to kind of find Nicholas in authentic history. What type of documents are we talking about?
There are, you know, Greek and Latin documents. Mm-hmm. I had a chance to spend some time in Bari, Italy, which is where there's an archive library in which all these documents are housed. And so what I was able to find, not only with evidence from all sorts of scattered documents, evidence for his existence, but also, and this was what I think maybe really is important for people who are novices about St. Nick or want to learn more about him, I was able to separate out St. Nicholas of Myra from another Nicholas. Typically, I mean, down through the ages, there have been two men named Nicholas, and their stories have been blurred and merged together so that when you hear, I don't know, popular accounts today of the life of St. Nicholas, it's typically the story of these two Nicolai that have been merged together. And it's an error that dates back 1,000 years, you know, but I was able to really show and go through the documents and show that these are actually two separate lives, and they need to be separated for history's sake, and so we can get a clear picture of who Nicholas was. So I think that's one of the things that readers will really find interesting in this book.
The life of the Saint Nicholas in which we're referring to is an extraordinary one. I mean, the recountings of his childhood and the bringing into the teachings that would help form the man, that I hadn't really seen chronicled out quite as clearly as that I did in your book.
Oh, that's great. I really wanted to get into, you know, the daily life and the experience of someone growing up in the ancient world, in a Christian home. How would a child be raised? It's one of the most neglected parts of history telling, the telling of childhood. Mm-hmm. And so I really wanted to try to recover as much of that as I could. You don't have many accounts of children or childhood experiences from antiquity, and so I think it's one of those parts of life that's so dearly important, but you know, is overlooked so much by historians.
Even the giving of his name, that Nicholas, could you share with us what that means? Because that's significant.
It is. The victory of the people and the people's victor. And so even in the name itself, there is hope and there is promise. It's inspiring, you know, just to know who he was. And he really lived out that kind of life. We think of him connected with gift-giving and with generosity. You know, but he was more than that. He was a businessman. He was a patron of the people. He acted as lawyer, as judge, as arbitrator. And he really worked for the people as a civil servant, in addition to being a wonderful Christian pastor.
Long before the late 19th century, 20, and then into the 20th century invention of who the persona of Santa Claus, St. Nicholas, you see him everywhere, Adam. When you go to Europe, he's everywhere, and especially in those areas in iconography and in the artwork of, well, that spans the last 1500 to 1800 years.
That's exactly right. Europeans have, in general, kept a stronger connection with St. Nicholas being a bishop, being a Christian pastor. Our American image of St. Nicholas, of course, Santa Claus, really sort of distancing him from any kind of Christian association. But in Europe, yes, he's still very much dressed as a bishop with a mitre hat and a cross and, you know, bishop's robes and a staff. And, you know, that's definitely one of the strong differences, I think, between maybe the European celebration of Nicholas, you know, in the American celebration. He's still very much a Christian saint there in ways that he really no longer is in the American context. And even the name, of course, Santa Claus, I mean, there's almost no sort of connection with the historical or Christian figure even in that name.
We need this Christian figure, this Christian teacher who was such a staunch and staunch advocate for and articulator of the importance of marriage.
He was. That was one of the parts that really drew me to him, that he did not buy into the idea that marriage is somehow less than God's ideal for people. You know, the ideal would be virginity, and that if you couldn't make virginity, then as a second option, you might go to marriage. And he really, his stories reject that idea. Nicholas saw marriage as a good and noble estate to be valued. And so, you know, one of those early stories, maybe the most famous one, he hears of three young girls who are on the door of destitution. I mean, they're 1 foot in the poorhouse, and in the middle of the night, and he goes by their window and tosses in a bag of gold so that they might have a dowry to get married. Mm-hmm. And that idea of a saint providing marriage money, mm-hmm, is shocking in its time. Why would anyone want to, you know, further this institution? Shouldn't we be abandoning the world and living lives of celibacy? And, you know, Nicholas's example is directly against that idea, saying, no, you know, marriage is a good estate, and it's something that should be celebrated. I think that's one of the reasons that people are drawn to him from early on, that he's that kind of ordinary person who understands real life and understands the value of marriage.
His participation at the Council of Nicaea is just one indicator of the type of background that he had, participating in important events in the life of Christendom, of our Christian history.
Yes, and the Council of Nicaea, for church history buffs out there, was maybe the most important council in church history, a very important council in which, in essence, the church decided for the first time, really, what are we going to believe about Jesus Christ? But what role does Jesus Christ have in the Christian faith? And of course, if Christianity is anything, it's about Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is the central doctrine of our faith. And up until this time, the year 325, the church had not, as a whole, with a unified voice, given a firm sort of definition or stance or position of who is Jesus and what do we believe about him? What is the essence of the faith? And an extremely important council. And Nicholas was there. He was part of the proceedings. We don't have any record of what he himself personally contributed, other than that he was in favor of orthodoxy. He was on the side of orthodoxy. There are some legends. One of the legends I mentioned in there that is one of the more funny ones is that, or I guess more glamorous ones, the arch-heretic Arius, who was, you know, the big enemy at the council, is standing up and, you know, saying things that are blasphemous against Jesus Christ, and Nicholas just can't stand it anymore, and so he stands up and slaps Arius in the face. And I've even seen a T-shirt that has Nicholas holding a sandal and says, "I got sandal slapped by Santa Claus," which is really funny. Unfortunately, it's not true, but it was a later medieval legend about him and his participation in the council, which would be great if it was true.
He lived during that period where, again, as you've shared with us, that time of great persecution towards the end of that era, into a whole new time when Christianity was allowed to flourish. And that had a lot of challenges, especially for those who are called to lead a church, to kind of stamp out some of the beliefs that had gotten so twisted and were leading people down a flawed path.
He did. That's another part of Nicholas' story that I think will surprise people. He was very much involved in the not only the propagation of Christianity, the proclamation of the message of the gospel, but also contending with paganism as he found it, and not only arguing with the pagans, but also at times shutting down the temples in his city and in other places, doing things that maybe in our more tolerant society might be frowned on, but I think it really also shows what's going on there at that moment, that this is a real contest of narratives, a real tournament of values, and Christianity is having to, in a sense, fight for its life against a whole host of traditional polytheisms and paganisms that are challenging it. And so each faith is battling out with the other. Christianity is able to, in a sense, come out on top. At that moment, Christianity is able to make its case, to be heard, and to win people over for the faith. But it's not without, you know, not only the Lord's help, but a good deal of effort and argumentation and hard work. And Nicholas is right there at that changing moment when people are ready maybe to give up some of these old superstitions and embrace something new.
What's really quite compelling is that when you, just in hearing you say that, is what good Bishop St. Nicholas would have to say to Santa Claus. And our veneration, in essence, as we now put Santa Claus in such a part of our Christian holy day.
You know, my parents definitely struggled with that interaction between Santa Claus and Christmas. They wanted us to remember that Jesus is the reason for the season, you know, while at the same time they wanted us to enjoy finding presents under the tree on Christmas morning and hearing the night before Christmas and those kinds of things. So I definitely understand the struggle that many Christians have with Santa Claus and the commercialization and then trying to also remember the reason for the season, the birth of our Lord and Savior. I guess here's where Nicholas can be of such value and such help, because we don't have to simply say no to Santa Claus. We can say yes to Nicholas. Here is a man who is a model of gift-giving, but also a model of Christian virtue. And so, you know, instead of simply kicking Santa Claus out of the house, we can invite St. Nicholas in and to participate. And, you know, one of the things that bringing a real awareness of St. Nicholas into the holiday season will do for you is that it will force you to look outside of your own home. You know, I'm not against at all the Christmas enjoyment of gift-giving. It's a very family-oriented day on the 25th of December. You know, but Nicholas's life was a testimony to giving outside of your own home, giving back to your community, and looking out for those in the greatest need. And so I think what Nicholas can really do is force us to not only give to those that we love, but give to those whom we don't know, whom we don't love. And so I think it can really add something big to our holiday traditions.
Well, and you so beautifully give us a full, rich vision of what his life must have been like. But even that, it must have been even more that goes beyond what could have been documented, because of the love and the reverence that people would have for this particular saint for so many years.
Definitely. And that's where I really struggled writing this book. Where do you stop? You could tell the story. I mean, the story can go in any which direction. For instance, this summer in June in Velikoretsky, Russia, 35,000 pilgrims walked 100 miles to a St. Nicholas shrine in veneration of Nicholas. I mean, they're celebrating Nicholas in the middle of June, walking 100 miles with smiles and big cheers for St. Nicholas. If you'd been in May in Bari, Italy, this past year, you'd see parades in the streets, people carrying big statues and signs for St. Nicholas. He's influenced and inspired so many people around the world, and you know, so there's so much of the tradition, so much of the story to tell beyond simply the you know, the Santa Claus story, and really even beyond his own life. I really wanted in this book, though, to focus on the man himself, the life of the man. I didn't want his life to get lost in all the other legends, all the other traditions that are so interesting and so important. But I wanted to focus on the actual man himself. But yes, there could be a dozen more books on the traditions of St. Nicholas and Santa Claus and gift giving.
Well, I suppose we should take a look at Santa Claus and how he became connected. The Santa Claus of the Coca-Cola ad became St. Nick.
Yes, you know, that is a fascinating story. It really, you know, I would say it really goes back to the early 19th century New York is where you have to look.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about that time that there are a number of influential men in New York connected with the New York Historical Society, Washington Irving, John Pintard, who are trying to establish new traditions, and they're trying to reconnect with their Dutch heritage.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of what it meant to be Dutch is to have Sinterklaas, to have Sinterklaas traditions and
mm-hmm.
St. Nicholas traditions. So if you gave St. Nicholas gifts or baked St. Nicholas cookies, that was sort of a sign that, you know, you were celebrating your Dutch traditions. And so it sort of catches on. I mean, there's this whole movement towards creating these new and kind of richly European traditions with St. Nicholas. Ultimately, you know, the idea of Santa Claus then, as those traditions start to morph and change, really become the creation of you know, the pictures of Thomas Nast and Norman Rockwell and Haddon Sundblom, as people are now trying to depict a saint who is warm and friendly and lovable and this kind of thing. So there's a long story there of how we get from St. Nicholas to Santa Claus, but really it starts back in the early 19th century mm-hmm. in New York.
Just to, again, to go back to the St. Nicholas, the stories of his generosity, I mean, I think that's where the root of all of this comes from. I mean, in that expression, so long ago, way back, I mean, the 300s.
It really is. And, you know, those stories of generosity were shocking even in their own day. I mean, they're still inspiring to us and motivating to us. But in a time when, you know, people lived scarce lives and, you know, they really went day to day wondering where their next meal might come from. And here's a story of St. Nicholas who is providing their needs and looking out for them. Ordinary people who have no other champion, and here is Nicholas. So it was truly inspiring, so that even by the early 1100s in France, you have nuns who are making little toys and leaving them on the doorsteps of children and signing them from St. Nicholas. It's inspiring, and anyone can do this. You know, I could go out and buy a bag of groceries and leave them on the doorstep of someone I knew was in need and mm-hmm. say it's from St. Nicholas. And so his actions are inspiring in that sort of ordinary way that people say, you know what, anybody can do this, and I could do it too.
It's such an enjoyable read, too. I mean, your enthusiasm for St. Nicholas, it comes through, and it really engages the reader. I mean, you can't help but be fascinated with your discoveries, but also with the joy you have in finding this life.
Well, that's great to hear. It has changed me. I mean, I didn't know what I would get into when I started researching 4 years ago the life of St. Nicholas, but I became mesmerized, spellbound with his life and with his virtues, and hopefully that does communicate through the pages.
Any final thoughts?
You know, I would just encourage listeners to begin to think about ways they might incorporate St. Nicholas into their holiday traditions. His feast day is on December 6th, and so doing something St. Nicholas-related on December 6th would be a great way to start off, you know, the Advent season, the Christmas season, and it would be a great opportunity for families or for churches or communities to do something not simply family-oriented, but reaching out to their community. I mean, to do something that is truly of the spirit of St. Nicholas is to do something beyond the walls of your own home in the community. So I would encourage, you know, again, families and communities to find ways to celebrate St. Nicholas by giving back.
Beautifully said, Adam. Adam English, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
With Adam English, we've gone inside the pages of The Saint Who Would Be Santa Claus, The True Life and Trials of Nicholas of Myra. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to saintwhowouldbesanta.com, the website for the book, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and or to download this discussion along with many others, go to discerninghearts.com. This has been a production of discerninghearts.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. Hi, this is Chris McGregor of Discerning Hearts, which is a 501c3 fully tax-deductible nonprofit organization dedicated to evangelization and spiritual formation through the use of new media. Discerning Hearts creates engaging multimedia specializing in podcasts and radio broadcasts, faithful to the teachings of the Roman Catholic Church and its rich, authentic spiritual tradition. We hope that if this has been helpful for you, that you will first pray for our mission. And if you feel us worthy, please consider a charitable donation, which is fully tax deductible, to support our efforts. We charge nothing for any of the programs that are available on Discerning Hearts, and our outreach is literally to the world. Please tell a friend about Discerning Hearts and either download our free apps, which are available at iTunes and Google Play stores, or visit discerninghearts.com.